Okay, so yeah, as I said, it's going to be about Confirm and Bootstrap, and please go ahead and ask me any questions at any time. It's supposed to be very, very informal and interactive, hopefully. All right, so before I begin explaining what Confirm and Bootstrap is, I would like to start with a sort of mathematical analogy. About what happened in mathematics in late 19th and early 20th century, which is kind of analogous to a situation where we might be in Confirm of Future nowadays. So, as I said, in late 19th and early 20th century, mathematicians were interested in understanding objects which I would describe as continuous families of transformations, geometric objects. So maybe let me. So let's call it the concept. The concept that mathematicians were interested in were continuous families of transformations. Like, for example, of course, you already know that such objects are described by Lie groups, but I don't want to call them Lie groups. I just want to call them by their mathematical physical conceptual property. Mm-hmm. There were various reasons to be interested in such objects. For example, the main such motivation is probably coming from geometry, where mathematicians hope to understand geometric objects in arbitrary number of dimensions in terms of their symmetry properties. Many examples were known at the time. They could typically be constructed as some sets of matrices closed under multiplication and taking inverses. So the most important examples were, for example, the orthogonal groups. We had the unitary groups or the symplectic groups. But these are pretty much the only examples of continuous families of transformation which are closed under multiplication and inversion or Lie groups. But it was a very interesting open problem to see if somehow the essence of what it means to be a continuous family of transformation could be abstracted into some set of axioms, and then possibly classify such objects. So indeed this turned out to be possible. So people managed to axiomatize where these essential ingredient turned out to be the fact that you should look at the neighborhood of the identity transformation, and then you can study the so-called Lie algebra around there. So the correct concept to look at the time was to look at the Lie algebra, and mathematicians wrote down axioms for these Lie algebras, which are essentially one-to-one correspondence with continuous families of transformations. And after you had these axioms, you could try to classify the objects which satisfy these axioms. And indeed, this turned out to be possible in a famous work of Killing and Cartan, where these guys classified all the objects satisfying the axioms of Lie algebra, or at least the so-called finite simple ones. And indeed, I guess the most interesting outcome of this classification was that of course the objects that we already knew as concrete examples, these orthogonal, unitary, and symplectic groups, were a part of the classification, but they also discovered some new ones, just purely as a consequence of these axioms. So it turns out that the classification of finite simple Lie algebras is extremely beautiful, and you can label them all by a sequence of infinite series. There are the A's, B's, C's, and D's. These letters correspond to various versions of these three kinds of Lie groups. But then there are also exceptional cases. There are three E's, one F, I think F4, and G2. And these groups, to my knowledge, were not known previously before the classification, but they were discovered purely as a consequence of this classification. It was like a huge success of this logic in pure mathematics. Now this the situation like this is fairly common in mathematics, that you can somewhat abstract the essence of some notion into a set of axioms, and then you can try to classify that object using the set of axioms. It is not so common in theoretical physics. Of course, it would be really great if almost any physical problem that we have could be answered in this kind of framework. But yeah, this unfortunately doesn't happen very often. But what I'm going to talk about today, namely conformal field theory, is an example of a situation where precisely this seems to be happening, where you can really write down some set of axioms, and you can try to maybe classify the conformal field theories based on that logic. We are still quite far from having such a nice, beautiful list as was discovered by Killing and Cartan, and probably it's quite impossible to achieve that, but one can still go quite far in this sort of program in the context of conformal field theory. Let me now make the analogy more precise. So sort of the physical concept in the case of conformal field theory that you start from is that you have some local physics, which is conformal error. I can say that some local system at criticality. So you probably know that in condensed matter, when you tune some parameters, the system become scale invariant, called critical, and is described by some local quantum field theory with an enhanced symmetry. But let me just write that sort of the physical concept. It would be criticality. Now it turns out that there are other important examples of conformal field theories where the other motivation comes from considering RG flow. So at the endpoints of RG flow are scale invariant, and when they are unitary, you can often show that they must also be conformal invariant. So let me just write endpoints RG flows. I think that Jaume discussed this in his first lecture, so I'm not going to go into details. So we have some physical concepts which constrain the physics. There at the moment we know quite many examples of such a situation where we can make some concrete statements. For example, one can write down lattice models, such as the Ising models, and if you tune parameters to go to criticality, you're going to find conformal field theory. Or you can just go directly to continuum and write down Lagrangians, etc. And luckily, as I already said, it's actually possible to abstract what really makes conformal field theories conformal field theories, and it's possible to write down a set of axioms that CFTs should satisfy. And this is going to be the core of my talk today, to describe these axioms and what they mean, how to understand them. So somehow the basic player in the axioms is the operator algebra. So somehow everything can be cast in the language of local operators of the theory. And then the conformal bootstrap equations, which I'm going to describe later, are the right axioms which constrain this operator algebra. Conformal bootstrap, okay. In terms of the classification, we are certainly not as far.
Probably modularity.
Modularity is understood how modularity. What are the concepts of modularity in two spacetime dimensions? But my talk is more general. It's not just in the context of two spacetime dimensions. It's an important problem to understand. Understand. Yeah. You can call it consistency of the quantum field theory when you put it on a general manifold. Yeah. But yeah. That's true. So somehow the conformal bootstrap, or the stuff that I'm going to be talking about today, are the constraints that are put on conformal field theories only from the purely local point of view. Only the constraints which constrain the dynamics at every point. Well, so in the classification was well, the only very small or relatively small progress was done was made in the context of two space-time dimensions. In the case where you have only finitely many basic building blocks. Again, it will become clear later what exactly I mean by building blocks. You probably already can anticipate if you follow the PSI course. But yeah, even in two dimensions, the classification is very incomplete. As I said, it is expected that only a small subset of the two-dimensional conformal field theories have only finitely many building blocks, and in particular, no. That I want to leave maybe for later. Yeah, actually, I would like to add one more aspect to this list, which is that approximately 20 years ago, it was realized that there is another physical source of theories which satisfy these axioms, and namely, these are theories of quantum gravity in anti-de Sitter space. So it's possible to convince yourself somewhat heuristically, but I think it's pretty believable. Let me just write it. Quantum gravity in ADS. So it's possible to convince yourself that any time you put quantum gravity into an ADS space, because ADS space is a boundary, the quantum gravity can be understood completely in terms of what's happening on this boundary, and indeed it defines some conformal field theory on the boundary. So if you study the axioms for quantum gravity in ADS, you'll find that these axioms are exactly the same as the axioms for conformal field theory living on the boundary of ADS. So in this way, problems which looked very different at the beginning are beginning to look very similar. So then I can add even some more examples. So the only consistent theories of quantum gravity that we have nowadays are string theories. So you could put string theory in some anti-de Sitter space of say dimension D, and because string theory is 10-dimensional, you need to supplement it with some compact manifold. So you're really putting string theory on ADS D cross some manifold of dimension 10 minus D. Okay. You can ask me questions later about this, but it's all right.
Can I ask one right now?
Sure.
So can you make the dictionary more precise? I guess the operator algebras are the excitations of the bulk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
What's the analog of conformal bootstrap?
That's right. So the operator algebra on a boundary corresponds to all the ways that you can perturb the quantum gravity purely on the boundary, which is basically the same as small modifications of the various fields in the bulk. So if you can. In the situations where you can write the quantum gravity theory in terms of a set of fields, and there will be infinitely many of them, there will be a correspondence between these fields and the operators on the boundary. But yeah, I guess then I would have to. This is not supposed to be a lecture about ADS CFT. So.
But roughly, what does conformal bootstrap mean in quantum gravity?
It is not really clear what is the physical meaning purely in the like quantum gravitational language. It's just. Of course, the quantum gravity theory also satisfies some consistency constraint like causality, and especially causality. And there is probably some kind of mapping between the various purely gravitational constraints and the CFT constraints. But yeah, it is certainly one of the very hot topics of research. But your question is very much at the center point of a big branch of research right now. Okay, so are there any questions about the big picture? I'll make many of the things that I said much more precise in the remainder, but so good. I hope this means that okay. Probably all I said was trivial. Okay, so now let's get down to business. Yeah, so what I want to describe now are the CFT axioms. You probably will have seen these many of the things which I'm going to say in the course, but perhaps I'll frame them from a slightly different point of view. Maybe not. That's also okay. It's good to see things multiple times. Okay, so how should you think of a CFT? Somehow we don't want to talk about CFT from any Lagrangian point of view, because we only know how to use Lagrangians in perturbation theory, and the approach that I would like to present is completely non-perturbative in nature. So the way that you should think about conformal field theory, at least for the purpose of this talk, is some kind of black box which computes for you any correlation function of local operators. So the CFT is really defined in terms of its spectrum of local operators. So let me call it S. So SS or calligraphic S is going to be the set of local operators. And the CFT is just some device which to an arbitrary set of local operators at arbitrary spacetime points assigns a number. So the CFT is just some object which, well, this correlation function of some set of local operators, these can be in general different operators at different spacetime points, assigns a number, some number in real numbers, for example. Okay. Now this black box is tightly constrained by various axioms, which I'm going to list now. The most important one is conformal symmetry. So we have conformal, or sort of the basic one. So we have conformal group, which when you put the theory in D Euclidean dimensions, then conformal group is SO 1, d plus 1, and it consists of the generators, of the following generators. They are the translations, the special conformal transformations, the dilatation, and the rotations. And any correlation function must be invariant under the action of this. Of these operators, but of course, for this statement to make sense, I must tell you how the operators transform under these transformations. So indeed, all the local operators of the theory are transform under the conformal group. So it makes sense to talk about irreducible representations of the conformal group as realized on the local operators. Yeah, so somehow the set of local operators is some in general infinite dimensional vector space generated by all the local operators, and this infinite dimensional vector space is a representation of the conformal group, and it turns out that you can always decompose it. You can always decompose S into irreducible representations of the conformal group. So the simplest irreducible representation of the conformal group is just the only one-dimensional representation, which is correspond to the identity operator. So the identity is always there, and then you have an in general infinite sequence of irreducible representations of the conformal group. Have you heard about the primary fields? I guess you discussed primary fields in the lecture. So there is precisely one primary field in each of these representations. So the irreducible representations precisely correspond to the different primary fields. So each of these FIs, so a given FI, is going to contain, okay, let me just write a square bracket, it's going to contain some primary field. Let me just write O at zero. Now what are the primary fields labeled by? Can somebody tell me what are the primary fields labeled by? So somebody who is not like a CFT expert. What are the properties of a primary field?
Yeah? It transforms nicely under the conformal transformation.
So oh, okay. That's a property in a different sense than I meant. I mean, what are the labels? Or what determines how the primary field transforms? Okay, sorry, what determines the way in which it transforms?
I think you were going to say that.
Yeah.
Ah.
So.
Sorry.
So it transforms nicely, which means that there are certain numbers, being the scaling dimension, the conformal spin.
That's right. Yeah.
You need anything else?
That's right. Yeah. That's it. Okay. So in general, if you did classification representations of a nice enough group, then you will find that the representations are labeled by quantum, by set of U1 quantum numbers under the maximal torus of that group. So the maximal torus here of this group consists only of D and the maximal torus of the SOD. So this generates SOD. So the quantum number under D is the scaling dimension, and the quantum number under rotations is the conformal spin, which in general will be some representation of SOD. So the labels that I assign to every primary field is the scaling dimension. Oh, sorry, this is a bit small, and an irreducible representation of SOD. Okay. Where D is the same D that appears D. So this SOD is all the MIJ, so all the rotations which fix the origin. Okay. But the whole conformal family, the whole irreducible representation, contains the primary and all of its descendants. And the descendants, well, they are just derivatives applied to the primary field. So I should also put an index. So A is the index of the representation of SOD. So if the operator is scalar, like probably you've mostly seen scalar operators in the course. Mm-hmm.
So it's still not fair to me why for every reducible representation you can associate like just one primary field.
Well, it's a property of the group. So if you study representation theory of SO1, D+1, the conformal group, then you will find that the whole representation, if the representation is so-called highest weight representation, which all of the representations in unitary CFTs must be, you'll find there is always a set of operators which are annihilated by the case. So the primary fields are, you probably have seen it, but let me just remind you, the primary fields are defined as the fields which are annihilated by all the k's when inserted at the origin. Well, I don't have to write this. Okay, so when I insert a primary field at the origin, if it's annihilated by all the k's, it's a primary field, and it's possible to show that in every representation that there are always such fields, and all the other fields in that representation can be obtained by applying derivatives to the primary fields. So somehow k's act like inverses of the derivatives. So I can take any number of derivatives, and then I can apply k's to take me back to the primary field. But there is always a primary field that I can use to generate all the other elements of the representation by applying p's. Okay, is it clear now?
Yes. So yeah, but for a given irreducible representation,
yeah,
there's just a unique primary field.
Well, there are as many. No, it depends how you define primary fields. If you define them using this equation, then there is a whole SOD representation, right? If there is no index here, if the row is just a scalar representation of SOD, there is just one. But in general, there is going to be a whole irrep of SOD worth of primary fields in that irreducible representation of the conformal group. Yeah. That's why
unitarity in the second one.
Hmm?
What's the role of unitarity?
The role of unitarity is that you need unitarity to show that all the representations are highest weight. So the conformal group also has non-highest weight states. They need to be highest weights because k decreases scaling dimension, and when the scaling dimension is too low, the representation is always non-unitary.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So this, in particular, scaling dimension must be positive. If you didn't have something to start from, then you could go as low as you want, and at some point after applying many k's, the scaling dimension would become negative, and then the representation is automatically non-unitary. But using unitarity, they're all highest weight, and they're always, there's always a primary key. Okay, and then we can have higher numbers of derivatives. Okay, and the whole representation is just the linear span of all these operators. Okay, I think that's probably so far. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's all very nice. That we have this linear structure, we can add things, and the whole structure is acted upon by the conformal group, and we can copy correlation functions. But what is the feature of CFTs, which is really, really constraining, is that we can also multiply these objects. This is called the OPE, the operator product expansion. So maybe, shall I just write it? Yeah, I think I'm going to go to a new blackboard. Yeah, so we can multiply any two operators, so any two. But okay, before I say that, let me just say that this sort of whole structure of descent of primaries and descendants ensures that it is essentially always enough to look at the properties of the primaries, because say if I know the correlation function of the primary fields, I always know the correlation function of all the descendants just by applying derivatives to the correlation function. So from this point on, it will always be enough just to talk about the properties of the primary fields, because the properties of the descendant fields are completely determined in terms of those of the former. So but okay, now we can multiply, as I said, there's a multiplicative structure in the space of operators. Did you see a derivation of why you can multiply operators in a CFT in the lecture? Have you seen the OPE in the lecture? Did somebody talk about it? And did they explain why it can be done? It's not just an ad hoc property. You can actually prove it in CFTs rigorously. But I don't think there is a proof in a general QFT. So, yeah, have you seen the state operator map? No. Okay, so let me just maybe write the OPE first, so and then I can maybe give a quick argument for why it holds. So I can take two operators, say OI at X. Let me just call it O1. And O2 at 0. And the claim is that in any correlation function, I can replace this product by a sum over operators of the theory with some coefficients. So now I'm basically expanding in this vector space. Right? So I'll call it O2. Okay, so in this case, J would be a sum over the basis of the space of all fields over calligraphic S. So basis of S. So I'm expanding. I'm putting the operators at the origin, and there is some C number, which might depend on X, which is just the coefficient of expansion in this basis. Now the reason why this holds. Essentially uses the state operator map that I can put one of the operators at the origin, say O2 at 0. Then I quantize the theory on concentric spheres. So this is in flat space, this is in RD. And I'm using the radial quantization. Then I put the other operator somewhere to one at X. And I can think of this object as sourcing a state on the sphere, right? If I don't put the O1, the O2 corresponds to a state on the sphere. But now inserting the O1 just means that I have another state on the sphere. So when I'm doing the path integral from the origin, I get some state on the sphere, and the state on the sphere can again be expanded in the original basis. So this expansion is literally just the expansion of the state sourced by these two operators on the sphere centered at the origin of radius 1 in terms of all the operators which I can insert at the origin. Okay, is this So this is the reason why it can be done, because only in CFTs I can invoke the regular quantization. Only in CFTs I can invoke the state operator map, and that's why in a CFT the existence of such an expansion is guaranteed. Okay, I guess should I review that 2 and 3 point functions are fixed by conformal symmetry, or I don't have to do that. Does anybody want me to review it? You want at least you want to ask a question, Nafis?
So in a QFT, can you not multiply to local operators, or can you not write the outcome in the basis of local operators?
I think it's
the multiplication holds asymptotically.
That's right. Yeah.
So the multiplication is valid only in the limit when they're very close to each other.
That's right, yeah.
I mean, if they're not very close to each other, does the product not define, or is it not a local operator? No, you cannot apply this argument, right? You can only apply this argument when you
that's
go very
right,
close.
That's right, yeah.
I mean, you have an argument to say that the product can be written as a linear combination of local operators.
No.
You can
still
go very close.
But you can bring everything close together. It's conformal.
If it is conformal, but certainly in a general QFT, if I have an expansion like this, it will only be asymptotic in the sense that the corresponding series expansion of a correlator where I use this in will not be a convergent expansion. So in CFTs there is always a region of the axis in which this expansion is a convergent expansion, is a convergent series, but in a general QFT it will not be convergent. It will just be an asymptotic, like in the usual mathematical meaning of the word asymptotic series, or something which is becoming more and more precise the closer you are, but it doesn't converge for any finite, for any non-zero value of x.
Oh.
Yeah, but the reason you cannot apply it in a general QFT is that you cannot. I mean, of course, you still have the state on the sphere, but now there is no correspondence between states on the sphere and under local operators. I cannot, in general, write under local operator at the origin, which sources me that correct state, right? That's the part that fails. Mm-hmm. Yeah?
Yeah? This might be a stupid question, but I still don't really understand how you can calculate a path integral and go from one state to another. I've only seen like correlation functions be calculated through path integrals.
Have you ever seen like the definition of a state in the path integral language, like as a functional on the fields? Okay, well, I don't think I have time to review that, but you should. I think it's an appendix in Polchinski 1, right? Where he explains the connection between Hilbert space formalism and the path integral. I mean, this is, you're basically asking me what is the connection between Hilbert space formalism and the path integral formalism? Yeah, so you should probably read. We can also talk later, but you should read an appendix to first Polchinski. Okay. Well, yeah. I'm sorry. I don't think I have time to review that the 2 and 3 point functions are fixed by conformal symmetry. So let me just say they are. And now, then you can use the OPE to reduce an n-point function to an n-point function. So using the OPE and using the fact that at least, I mean, in principle, we just need 2 point functions to be fixed, right? Because I can even reduce a 3 point, well, I can even reduce a 2 point function to a one point function of identity. So the only thing that you really need now is to know that 1 point functions are fixed, which is true, which is, I guess, more obvious than 2 and 3 point functions. Okay, so it's, okay, I should say a few more things about the OPE, I think. So we can also, now in the OPE, we can use this structure of primaries and descendants to organize the sum according to the conformal family. So instead, basically, I'm going to group together all the operators in here, which are in the same conformal family. I'm going to sum only over the conformal families. So I... All these calligraphic S. And then I need to, so I need to sort of enrich the expansion. Well, so now I need to sort of include some descendants under as the same in the same summand, right? So I'm going to have an operator capital A, which depends on the operators 1 and 2 and the operator I. But now I can also this thing can also contain some derivatives. So we're now OI. We're now OI is a conformal primary, and I get all of its descendants by appropriate terms in this capital A. And the point is that an important consequence of conformal symmetry is that this object is completely fixed by conformal symmetry. So in other words, the contribution of all the descendants to LPE is completely fixed in terms of the contribution of the conformal primary. Fixed by conformal symmetry. So the only undetermined number or the only undetermined object being this number. So in principle this capital A is going to start as a function of x with no derivatives. So the first term with no derivatives, so when I imagine setting derivatives to zero, it's just going to be the primary. So C 1 to I dictates how much the primary contributes to the OPE. So this is the only number which is, I don't want to write it, which is not fixed by conformal symmetry. And it should be easy to see that the C to I is basically is essentially the three-point function of O1, O2, and OI. So this is the same as the number which appears as the normalization of the three-point function O1, O2, and OI. Am I being too quick or is this clear? It's clear so far?
What is the position of O1 or
O2? So in general, there's some dependence on position, right? But the overall coefficient is unfixed. So this is the overall coefficient. Okay. In some normal, it doesn't. You just choose some normalization and. Okay, so now it seems like all of the correlation functions of the theory are fixed by the following set of data. Well, we have the scaling dimensions. I should say that the scaling dimensions enter this object, right? Because it will certainly matter the scaling dimensions of these guys to fix the dependence on x. So certainly the correlation functions are fixed by the scaling dimensions and the corresponding representations of the primary fields. And also the set of all the Cijks where ij and k run over all the primary fields or the conformal families. Okay, is it clear why this is the case? Just using the OPE to reduce down to two or three point functions, where everything is certainly fixed in terms of deltas and Cijks. Okay, now you can ask. So is there one to one correspondence between consistent CFTs and these sets? Well, it turns out not to be the case because there are constraints which. Their idea, which constrain these sets of numbers, so that not an arbitrary choice of these things in general will not lead to a consistent conformal field theory, and the reason is that we need to impose that this multiplication is associative. So this is really what conformal bootstrap is. OPE must be associative. So if I imagine writing down a product of three operators at three different positions. So now by the way, I'll always drop the index corresponding to the SOD representation. So we'll just imagine that all the primaries are scalar. Yeah, so if I just write down the product of two or three operators at three different positions, I can imagine using the OP in various ways. For example, I can first fuse OI and OJ to get me one operator, and then I can fuse the result with OK, and this will give me some double. This is a bit unfortunate. I'm sorry. I'm just going to, for simplicity, I'm just going to call them O1. I apologize if you're taking notes. I'm just going to call them O1, O2, and O3. So there is one expansion where I'm going to sum over I, which gives me these coefficients. So I'm fusing O1, O2 to get an operator I. Then I'm fusing the result, the OI, with O3. So I'm summing over operator J and C I J 3. And then I'm getting some complicated function of the x's, so the xk's and derivatives acting on operator J at some point, for example, x 3. Yeah? But I could imagine doing the OP in a different way. For example, first I would fuse O2 and O3. And in that case, I'm going to get, again, a double expansion, but I have different structure constants. I have C2, 3i, and C1ij, and some, in general, some different operator, depending on the x case and derivatives, acting on the operator OJ at x3, for example. Yes, yeah, so the fact that all of these expansions that I can do on the three operators are the same is a constraint on the C's, right? Because now if I look at any basis element on the right hand side, so any conformal family, OJ, the corresponding coefficient must match on the two sides. So this is a very non-trivial quadratic constraint on the C's, which also depends on the various deltas, because deltas enter the B and B tilde. Okay. It is most practical to cast this in the language of a four-point function. So you basically just repeat what I already said. So we want to sort of project this equation onto one conformal family. So you want to match the coefficients of a given OJ on the right-hand side. So the way to do this in practice is to multiply the whole thing by OJ at some position and take the four-point function, because this is guaranteed to only pick up on the right-hand side the correct conformal family using the fact that two-point functions are orthogonal. Right? So what? Okay. So what you want to do is to take a four-point function. So the first three operators are the operators whose associativity we want to test. And we test it against a fourth operator. So we project the equation into a fourth operator. And now we can expand in this equation in two different ways, either fusing these two and then these. Well, there are actually three different ways to do this. But in the end, you're going to get some equations which take the following form. So for example, if we expand in the OP the product O1, O2, we'll find OP coefficient C12i, and we create an operator OI, and we compute the three-point function, OI, O3, O4, which means that we'll find this OP coefficient. And then we are going to find some function. Let me call it 1, 2, 3, 4, I of the x's, of the xj's. But this function is completely fixed in terms of the conformal symmetry, in terms of the properties of the operators. And so because both the OPE and the three-point function that we compute afterwards is fixed by conformal symmetry. And now I can perform a similar calculation, but in a different channel. So I can fuse, for example, O1 and O4. Giving me 1, 4, i, and then I'm going to fuse the result with 2, 3. Maybe like like this. Sorry, J. And again, X case. Maybe I should write K here, inconsistent. And the conformal bootstrap. I mean, this all the possible equations that you can write down in this way are called conformal bootstrap equations. And the sort of the big hope is that this set of axioms for conformal field theory is essentially a complete set of axioms that somehow conformal field theory should be in one-to-one correspondence with solutions of these constraints. So conformal field theories should be in one-to-one correspondence with the sets of deltas and CIJKs which satisfy all the possible equations of this form. So let me just write in here sort of the hope, which is certainly very far from being proven or even fully exploited, certainly, is that CFTs are in one-to-one correspondence with these delta I rho I, with all the possible choices of these objects, subject to all the possible equations of these forms. So these equations are labeled by a choice of four primary operators of the theory. So of course this is a very complicated set of axioms. In general, there are infinitely many of them because you can usually convince yourself that there must be always infinitely many conformal primaries in any conformal field theory.
Why is this not a proof?
Hmm?
Why is this not a proof of the hope?
Why is what not a proof? I didn't prove anything.
The argument that you gave is a proof of this hope, right?
No, it could be that there are some further constraints, such as, for example, as you mentioned, modulo invariance. It could be that
CFT is on flat space.
That's right. Yeah. If you don't want to worry about putting CFTs on other manifolds, then correct. But then there are other complications, like there are non-local operators, as you know very well. There are operators which are not local, and maybe there could be some further consistency constraints coming from... I mean, it could also be that, for example, a given set of local operators might not be consistent with every possible set of non-local operators. There are all kinds of questions you want to ask. But this is a very good first approximation to what a CFT should be.
I mean, all we proved is that CFTs need a certain consistency
mm-hmm.
condition, and that implies that the conformal bootstrap equation.
That's right.
We didn't prove
and
that the conformal bootstrap
correct.
Equation
is
sufficient in any sense.
Correct. And actually, this was the point of view of the community for many years. It was believed that maybe with the exception of 2D, the conformal bootstrap is not very constraining. But then approximately 10 years ago, a few papers appeared which analyzed 4D CFTs, where they showed that these equations are actually extremely powerful, much more powerful than anybody had hoped before. And that's what I'm going to, I guess, talk about in the last 5 minutes. But before that, I wanted to say a few more things, like in general. I would like to maybe mention some questions that one might hope this approach to CFTs will be able to address. So, of course, the huge advantage of this approach is what I already said at the beginning, is that it's completely axiomatic, completely systematic. Mm-hmm. There are no funny... You don't need to worry about any of the usual problems that burden you in QFT, like UV divergences. There are no UV IR divergences in this approach. You have a completely well-defined set of axioms, convergent expansions. It's completely mathematical rigorous and doesn't rely on perturbation theory, so you're all set. But so you have a hope that this approach might address some long-standing questions in quantum field theory. So questions. So CB, I mean, from Bootstrap. That's my address, but it's a very young field, so many of these questions that I'm going to mention have been studied to some extent, but have not been addressed fully, I think. So some of a prototypical example is whether we can solve the 3D Ising model. So the 3D Ising model is a unitary three-dimensional conformal field theory. Which satisfies all these axioms, certainly. And later, in a few minutes, I'm going to say more about how conformal bootstrap has been used to very tightly constrain the 3D Ising model, or essentially solve it numerically. But then there are other important CFT questions, which mostly pertain to the connection to gravity. So, for example, you might wonder whether you can identify the three dimension of CFT, which corresponds to the Einstein gravity in ADS4. So you have, of course, in principle, a whole zoo of quantum gravities in 4D, but there should be the simplest one, which corresponds to Einstein gravity.
That's not consistent, right? Is Einstein gravity consistent in ADS?
So the simplest UV completion of Einstein gravity that is consistent. By Einstein gravity, I mean the theory whose low energy spectrum only contains gravitons, only contains gravitons, let's say. So there is only a stress tensor on the CFT and a big gap. And hopefully the gap is going to grow with the size of ADS. So you know what it means to be big. Yeah, we can discuss later. So can we construct the ADS CFT dual of pure gravity? In ADS4. Or in general, you might of course ask, what is the space of quantum gravity theories? We have a pretty good understanding of how to do quantum gravity using string theory, but there is no proof that string theory is the unique theory of quantum gravity, even though it's the only one which seems to be really working nowadays. But you could use this conformal bootstrap completely rigorously to understand the space of quantum gravity theories in ADS, because any quantum gravity theory, when you put it in ADS, is going to define for you a CFT on the boundary, so you can study this question completely rigorously. And perhaps one day you're going to discover a quantum gravity in ADS4, or ADS5, which is not a string theory. Then there's also other interesting questions which mostly relate to CFTs which we know that they should exist, but we don't really have a useful Lagrangian description of them. For example, it is harder and harder to construct CFTs as you increase the number of spacetime dimensions. So because as you increase the number of spacetime dimensions, so in general, how do you obtain CFTs from a Lagrangian? I mean, you run a Lagrangian, which is like an RG flow from a free theory, and you hope that you're going to get some CFT in the IR by tuning parameters. But because dimensions of fields and their interactions grow with spacetime dimensions, it becomes harder and harder to build relevant interactions in more and more spacetime dimensions. So for example, the phi to the 3 interaction, the phi to the 4 interaction is irrelevant above 4D. The phi to the 3 interaction is irrelevant above 6D. And actually, above 6D, there are no relevant interactions that you can write in a free Lagrangian at all. So there is actually a conjecture that there are no interacting CFTs in more than 6 dimensions, because you cannot obtain them. You can certainly not obtain any interacting CFTs by large flow from a free theory in more than 6D. And even in 6D is kind of hard, but there are these very interesting 2.0 theories. So I'm just going to list it as an example. There's a construction in string theory using M5 brains of very interesting supersymmetric six-dimensional interacting field theories, but we don't really have any useful description of them at all, except for the bootstrap. So at the moment, bootstrap is the only approach which can, tell you rigorous results about quantities which are not protected by supersymmetry. Well, maybe I'm not going to write it, but let me just say that bootstrap can maybe answer the question whether there are interacting CFTs in more than 6D. We don't know any examples at the moment. We don't know of any examples at the moment, but perhaps if we just implement these bootstrap axioms in D equal to 7, we are going to find that there is a beautiful solution sitting there, which we had no idea that existed before, and that will be a good evidence that there is an interacting CFT in 7D. Or maybe we'll be able to use the axioms to prove that there are no interacting CFTs in 6D. And many people have been thinking about this, I think, so far unsuccessfully. Okay, so now the time is up.
Is there a super version of this?
Of bootstrap? Absolutely. For any amount of supersymmetry that you wish, you can repeat the whole procedure. You just enhance the only thing that you need to change really is this. You change this group to some super group. You add some generators. Again, you have irreducible representations of these. These are called superconformal families, superconformal primaries. And you have their crossing equations. And cool thing is that sometimes these supersymmetric analogs admit closed subsectors which are completely solvable. So in the non-supersymmetric case, all these equations are very hard and sort of like, well, independent and hard to study. But in some supersymmetric examples, there are like closed sub-equations which have only finitely many contributions, and they are completely analytically solvable. Yeah. So okay, now I can talk about. Well, you, first of all, whoever wants to leave can leave, and I can talk about the 3D easing model more, or I can just take any questions that you have.
Can I just ask?
So let me maybe turn this off so that anybody can ask a question. Nobody is intimidated by being recorded. Okay, it got. So I'm turning off the microphone.
Okay, now the party can start.
Okay.
So I have a basic question. Can all the descendants of a primary be written as derivatives of the primary?